Hello and welcome to episode 4 in this series of the True Tales of Luxury podcast. I'm joining you from the oh-so-luxurious surroundings of the Harrods Perrier Jouet bar this week, where in just a few moments I'll be sitting down for a socially distanced chat with my good friends, the editors Stacey Duguid and Katie Service. I'm so excited to see how the girls are going to find a way to top the beguiling objects they brought along last time we met, and I'm confident that I have something pretty special up my sleeve too. And as always, once we finish showing off our prized luxury items, I'll be chatting to an esteemed figure from the world of modern luxury. This week, our guest is the one and only Sameer Lilani of Amrapali Jewellery. Creating jewellery with an eclectic Indian aesthetic for the young at heart, Amrapali have become experts in crafting beautifully individual designs. They even have their very own jewellery museum in Jaipur. How brilliant is that? So let's not keep Stacey and Katie waiting a moment longer. Now, I am going to kick off, actually, because I wanted to say we're in the Perrier Jouet bar, because I'm actually bringing today a plate and some knives and some forks. You feeling hungry?
It's edible.
It's edible. I have here two different types of cheese. Now, have you been to the Harrods Cheese Bar in the food hall?
Should I tell you, every time I go there, I look... freak out at the choice and I walk off. I would love a proper cheese tutorial.
Well, you know, the person to know, actually, I've discovered, is Bernadette. Bernadette is our cheese and ham buyer, and she is one of the most respected and esteemed women in the industry. And what we're about to try today is down to Bernadette, because she gets the most extraordinary invites to the most extraordinary places. Now, do you know what this cheese is? Have a little smell. This is a Comté.
I was going to say that.
Yeah. A Comté is like the sort of French cheddar, if
Hang
you
on.
Like.
Comté, not Comté.
It's Comté. It's Comté.
See, I'm so northern. I was very sorry. Comté.
Now, it comes from the Jura in France, which is just on the border of France and Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And it's the farmers of this special type of cow called the Montbéliard cow use the milk to make the cheese. And only cheese from this region can be called Comté. But it's not the farmers who are the quality control, if you like. It's actually the affineur. Now, the affineur, this is a French word. Is my accent good enough, Stacey?
Well, I'm very good at foreign languages, as we all know. The affineur, I'm assuming that's the final point at which it becomes cheese?
Well, the process of the cheese maturing, if you like, is called by this Comté syndicate, if you like, affinage lent, which is basically slow maturity. So it's a bit like slow food, slow maturity. And these guys in the 1960s decided that actually it was being over-industrialized, the agricultural production, and it should slow it right down and let the cheese just do its thing. So this cheese, it's actually eaten relatively young for some cheeses. It can actually be eaten as young as 6 months. And Comté can also go as old as 30 months. But what happens is the cheese masters are called the affineur. And the affineur go around the farmers and they choose the best wheels. So cheese is made in a wheel, and take it to the cellars at the bottom of a mountain in the Jura, put them in the cellars. And after about 6 months, through a process of basically tapping the cheese and smelling it, they can tell which is the cheese which they say has real promise. Now, if it has real promise, it is, and not many of them do, it is then taken up the mountain to an old hill fort and put into this hill fort, which is basically perfect conditions for maturing cheese. Lots of kind of stone arches and then lots of soil on top of the fort. So it's buried in the mountain, if you like. And then it's left in there for another 6 to 18 months. Now, there's 100,000 wheels in there, but that's for the whole world. And The wheels that tend to have the legs to last, if you like, are the wheels that are the most sort of aspired and desirable wheels. And the 30-month-old wheels, you just never know how many there are going to be of them. So apparently last year, only 30 of these wheels were actually released for the whole world. Bernadette got 6 of them.
How did she manage that?
Well, she has very good relationships with the affineur. That's all I can say. Now, I'm just going to slice this up for you because obviously you need to try this. Now, the ones, Harrods always apparently gets wheels because Bernadette's so brilliant. This is what's called the Harrods Reserve Comté. And I think this one is probably about 6 months old. Katie, do you like to try some?
Oh, word. I can smell it. It's exquisite.
Aside from the amazing cheese, can I just say the little wrapping that it comes in is so sweet.
Oh, everything about the food halls is so fantastic, isn't it? Tell me what you're tasting. What can
sweet.
You taste? Yep. So what I have here to show you is what's called the Comté flavour wheel. So this is great. This is specific to Comté. People know what a flavour wheel is. It's basically a circle of different flavours. And the different types of Comté are divided into these flavours: roasted, fruity, lactic, spicy, animal, and vegetal. And according to Bernadette, the Harrods customer particularly likes the animal flavours. So she says these are ones that are sort of a lot more umami. So more kind of roast beef, roast lamb type of flavours. I know you're a vegetarian. No meat died in the making of this. It's just the flavour, Stacey.
You can see
calm
my
down.
Face, right?
I know I can see your face.
I'm sorry. So we're saying that on this wheel that's looks a lot like an artist colour wheel, that this is within the animal section, are we saying?
It is.
I would say it was in the fruity section, wouldn't you? Well, smooth. It tastes like honey.
You're right. It is actually, they're so complex, the Comté flavour. It has a lot of fruit in it. But this overlaid on top of it, and this one I'm giving you now is the 30 months, so this is a hugely rare Comté. See if you can taste the umami flavours in that.
Oh my goodness. Rosemary?
Let's read the umami flavours. Meat broth, leather, wet wool.
Oh my God, it's so good.
Hard-boiled egg yolk. Horse.
Horse?
I won't read the next one.
It tastes like horse.
Cow manure.
It's hearty tasting, isn't it?
It is. It's a lot more umami. And I think that Comté can be very, very fruity.
Wow.
And you're right to recognise the fruit. But this one is it has the fruit, but on top of it, it has the animal head on top.
Yeah. That is incredible. I had no idea there's a flavour wheel.
Absolutely. Anyone for a biscuit?
Yes, please.
Right, that's me done. Were you impressed?
Very impressed. Can we keep
very
the
impressed?
Cheese
yes,
talk?
Absolutely. Let's move to Stacey next. What have you got?
Ah, right. Let's have a look in my bag of tricks over here.
You always have it underneath your seat.
I do. This is one of my favourite things.
I know what that is.
It's my favourite thing in the whole world. I'll tell you why. This is by Gabriella Hearst. It's a little architectural top handle bag called the Diana bag. It's named after Diana Ross. And there is a waiting list for this exquisite piece. It is in the shape of a concertina.
Like an accordion.
An accordion. It looks like an instrument. It looks like an instrument meets architectural objet, meets handbag. Tiffany.
Can I just say, I am very familiar with this bag because I was lucky enough to go and interview Gabriella and hang out with her a bit in New York. And then I went to the British Fashion Awards with her in November as her guest and sat on the table. And several people on the table had this bag. So I was familiar with the bag anyway. Several people had the bag. And it's one of those bags that when you go out, well, when we go out again, you put it on the table and people come over and talk to you. And what is that? And it's a real conversation piece. But what I have not seen before is this version, which is a gorgeous midnight blue velvet with
suede,
with gold or brass work
on the top handle. Let me open it up for you, ladies.
It's an exquisite combination.
So it's got a push button at the top, and then it opens up into a kind of rectangle. So that if you imagine the sort of the folds of the concertina fold flat. And then you have everything in view right there.
And you can actually fit stuff in there, right?
You can definitely fit stuff. Unlike when I went to BAFTA earlier this year and carried such a small bag, someone had to carry my foam. So it's reminiscent of the bellows of an accordion. It's such a beautiful piece. But the thing I love about it, probably one of the most, iconic things about this bag, the fact that it has no logo. Absolutely no logo. To me, this is pure stealth luxury.
Doesn't need to say Gabriella Hearst. I mean, no one else has come up with a design like that. But you know, this returns us to our conversation in the previous episodes, which is investment buying, right? So Gabriella says you only need one bag and you keep it for your life. And actually, she carries the prototype of the Diana. So because she's so massively into sustainability. So when she designed and made the first bag, she was like, right, that's my bag. And that's just the bag that she has, just that one bag.
Do you know, so I wanted to talk to you about her sustainability. And you, I know you know this because I know you're passionate about the brand, Tiff. But in February at New York Fashion Week, she hosted the very first, she put on the very first carbon neutral fashion show in the world. I mean, and nobody has ever managed to pull that off. I mean, that's an incredible
thing. Her entire business is carbon neutral. Her offices, her supply chain.
She's 99% sustainable in terms of her fabrication. Even her elastics are biodegradable. You know, what she wants to do is get us back to a sort of fashion food chain that predates nylon and elastic. She, by 2022, apparently wants to be using no more raw materials. So that's everything will be recycled. So in the last collection, I think you were there, weren't you, Tiff? Did you go to New York and you saw that show? So those Turkish rugs. Mm. So she put together actual rugs and sewed them into a coat. So those are one-off pieces.
It was like Joseph Technicolor Dreamcoat. It was so
fabulous. I mean,
so
incredible.
Fabulous.
The pictures are amazing. I wish I could have been at that show. It's just sleek luxury. And what I love about this bag, it's almost becoming, and this is a really big statement, but it's almost becoming as iconic as an Hermes Birkin. There are so many people on the waiting list for it.
Really?
We can't keep them in stock, apparently. But it's,
well, they're made to order, which is one of the other things I love about her. So she does this made to order for the bags because she doesn't want to flood the market with her bags and she wants them to remain completely desirable, which I love. But then there isn't an overproduction element. So everything is kept really, the distribution of this bag is very, very small. And I think that's actually brilliant. She's from Uruguay. She lives between New York. She's obviously married to a Hearst. John Austin, she calls him. Hearst, and
but you know what her
he's
background
a business partner.
Is. Her family.
Well, I was about to go into that. So she's a sixth generation rancher from Uruguay. Her mother lives on a ranch 10 miles away and has a 6,000 acre ranch.
Her mom's from Montevideo.
Yes. And Gabriella has a 10,000 acre ranch. She has 6,000 sheep, 9,000 cattle. She has over 100 horses. And she visits the ranch several times a year, has to take three planes, one of which is a two-seater. And she oversees this ranch as well as overseeing her fashion empire. I'm obsessed with her. I mean, I don't know. I can't imagine what it was like to interview her.
She's so intelligent. She's a very educated and learned woman. She can sort of flit between 19th century philosophers and Nobel Peace Prize winning chemists. I mean, and she really courts that woman as a customer. She wants women who change the world, who make a difference, who are women of substance, to be the women wearing her clothes. And those sort of women seem to gravitate towards her. I mean, I aspire to be like that. And I find her and everything that she does completely mesmeric. Oh, Stacey, thank you so much for bringing this along today. It's so beautiful. I thought I knew Gabriella Hearst, but I didn't know that this came in navy blue suede.
Can I just finish with this amazing saying, which I'm going to pronounce in terrible Spanish? Ese despacho por las piedras aras. That sounds like I'm Welsh.
In the same episode as she said cont.
I'm basically now Welsh Spanish. And this means, it's a famous Uruguayan saying, it means slow down when you're going over stones. And I think, and that's her mantra.
What a good mantra for
now.
I just
love it. It's perfect for now.
Right, Katie, over to you. Beat that.
Well, what I have brought, it doesn't look quite as fancy or as out there.
Lancôme.
Okay, it looks quite like a regular foundation, right?
Mm-hmm. Do you know what I love about the packaging already? That it's white.
Why do you love that?
Because I feel that everything is so brightly coloured these days and it just upsets me in my bathroom cabinet.
And now you just have this wonderful, minimal vision of a foundation in front of you.
Do you know what? Stacey's completely right, because I've been using décolleté for the last few months, and that's a white bottle with a sort of crystal lid, and it looks beautiful on my bathroom shelf.
Well, it's kind of ironic that the bottle is white, because this is a foundation that we stock in the beauty hall in the Lancôme boutique downstairs. There are actually 72,000 possible shades of this foundation.
Oh, my goodness.
Right?
That's more than my chandelier.
So it's called Le Teint Particulier, and it's a custom-made, we're talking about made to order and made to measure, it's a custom-made foundation. And we have a machine downstairs on the counter, which anybody can use, but not many people know about, which will scan your skin for the micropigments in there and mix you up a foundation that not just sort of like suits your skin tone, exactly matches the micropigments in your skin.
Row us back. How do they do that? I'm in there already.
So let me walk you through it. Okay, so you walk to the Lancôme counter, you sit down. They're going to cleanse and clean your skin and prep it, because obviously testing a foundation is no good on your kind of already daytime skin. You want to put it on in the same way as when you would in the morning. Okay, so cleanse, a little bit of serum, a little bit of moisturizer. Then they take a sort of device, which looks a little bit like a phone. They hold it against your skin, and a special algorithm detects the micropigments of color within your skin. And we've all got completely unique skin tones. So, you know, there is no sort of 14 shades of skin tone. There is, everybody has different elements of color all in all the different parts of their skin. They have different pigmentations. You might have melasma, you might have acne scarring, you might have redness. Anyway, so it detects all of that. And then all of this information goes into a little iPad. The lady presses go. And from a machine in front of you, you can see your foundation being blended. And there are mixes, variant mixes, depending on your skin and what they've read, which are pure red, pure blue, pure yellow, and pure white pigment. But not only that, they can also detect how dry or moisturized or oily your skin is. And they add a varying level of moisturizer. And you can also choose whether you want it to be full coverage, medium, or sheer. So you end up with, and I want to sort of read to you the small print on the front of this label. You end up with a label that goes on front that has your complexion ID. So mine is 045-40269.
That sounds like Elon Musk's child.
It does indeed. I might start calling myself that. And which means that I don't then, when I buy my new bottle of foundation, I don't have to be scanned again. They have me on file. They've got my foundation ID, and they can just print me out a new one, which is great. It also gives you the batch number, because obviously it's...
So you can go back and get it again.
Well, so that you know when the shelf life is finished. Because, I mean, how much do you have in your cupboard, do you reckon, that
is the shelf life?
Well, so if you turn your skincare or your foundation or whatever to see the reverse of the label, there is always a little number next to a little pot. So it might say 6M or 12M or 3M, and that means it has a shelf life of 6 months or 12 months or 3 months. So that's how you know when you should be... I mean, I've honestly, when I found that out, I went, and then went home and had to throw out basically everything I own.
Yeah, I don't think I ever even knew that.
Exactly.
Does it have SPF in it?
So this one doesn't, but I actually... I don't know about you, I quite like wearing my SPF layer as a separate layer, because I don't like wearing it all the time. Like if I know I'm going to be
like
inside all day and in the evening,
yeah, of
it's
course.
Just like, I suppose, an extra chemical. And I like to know as well that with a foundation, I might only apply it to my T-zone, for example, and maybe my jawline or a bit of my forehead. Whereas with an SPF layer, you can be sure that you get it like all over your face,
okay.
I suppose.
That's a really good point. Yeah, no, you're right.
This is really a revolutionary product, because I suppose it's incredibly topical that there are some failings within the beauty industry for not covering enough shade numbers. And there are brands that have always had diverse spreads, like MAC, for example, since it launched, was revolutionary in that you could find different undertones of your skin tone and a huge breadth of colours. Fenty came along and shook up the industry recently with 40 shades, which is now 50. That really doesn't compare to 72,000 possible shades.
It's insane. Is Lancome the only company doing this kind of technology?
So yeah, I mean, we've seen it. We've got other brands in our beauty hall, which can, for example, lipstick shades, so La Bouche Rouge. You can find the exact pigment. You can match your lipstick to a handbag that you bring in or a dress or something like that. They go off and match the shade in the lab in Paris. But yes, this is the only kind of technology that we have, I think, in the UK that's available to people to just walk into the store, into the boutique, and just match themselves. And it is amazing, I think. And not only that, but I think it teaches you a lot about your skin and your skin type and your skin tone if you have to start thinking about what undertone it is and what skin is comprised of.
Katie, thank you so much for bringing that along. 72,000 shades, that's incredible. Now, are you ready to be dazzled? Our guest for this episode is Sameer Lalani of Amrapali Jewellery. He's here to tell us about the colourful and the exotic as perfected by the Amrapali Jewellery House, founded in 1978 in Jaipur, India. Perhaps in these times of keeping our distance from each other, it's the perfect moment to wear jewellery that sings from a distance. Only one way to find out, and that's to ask the expert himself. So Sameer, it is so lovely to have you here today. Welcome to Harrods.
Thank you.
Now, you are the commercial director, Amir, for Amrapali Jewellery, which is a very business-sounding name. But as the representative for Amrapali over here, you have something of a reputation as being the spirit of the brand.
Thank you.
And actually, guys, you can't see Sameer here, but he's wearing the most incredible Vivienne Westwood cardi coat, and he's got beautiful jewellery on his wrists and around of his neck, and it looks amazing. So I'm just going to start with jewellery for men.
Yep. So this has actually been a huge growing area over the last 10 years. I think it started with this very, I hate the word, but I'm going to use it, bling. And now it's kind of developed into a lot more personal and masculine style jewellery. So like the bangles which I wear, this is an antique bangle. This is from Cartier, so and things like carved emeralds on cords.
I love that, by the way. It's a beautiful emerald. Where's it from?
This is Zambian.
It's around your neck.
Yep. It looks blue.
And I have Zambian always have secondary color blue as a hue, and carved emeralds. And we've actually launched this collection. It will properly be in stores now from next week.
And is that a kind of, what's the cord that you've got it on?
Cotton cords.
Cotton cord. It looks so cool. With this beautiful emerald set in a gold, and then on this cotton cord, it looks great on you.
Yeah, and it came from something that myself and my CEO, we both wear these kind of things, and we get a lot of clients asking us for these things, which are a lot more organic and much more masculine than flashy diamonds or...
And that, I think, is what sets Amrapali apart a little bit. I mean, it's very much an Indian jewellery brand, isn't it, with an Indian jewellery aesthetic. And it's different from a lot of the other brands we have here, which are very sort of diamond-based and so on. There's a lot of stones and so on. Tell us what you love about Amrapali.
So I love the colour. We come from Jaipur. Jaipur is the world centre for coloured stones. First and foremost, it's all about colour and it's all about coloured stones. And I think that we found ourselves a nice niche that if you want a 1 or a 2 carat diamond, you can go to 15 or 20 different jewellers here in Harrods and you can find a 1 or 2 carat diamond. Whereas if you want an emerald, which is Colombian no oil, we'll have that. If you want Colombian minor oil, if you want Zambian, if you want Afghani, if you want a 2 carat, if you want a 5 carat, you want a 7 carat. So our depth and our strength is really coloured stones. Emeralds, I've mentioned, are our strongest of all stones, but also with other coloured stones. So, of course, sapphires, rubies, and more and more people are trying and a lot more experimental. So we Paribas.
They're really hot right now, Paribas.
Paribas are super hot, yeah. And Brazilian or Mozambique. Very neon blue colours. Brazilian are hugely, are where the original source is and hugely sought after, and Mozambique more and more.
I mean, the stones are obviously hugely important, and I've always, there's the power behind crystals, there's birthstones. Is there a sort of feeling that different gems bring different powers or, different talismans, if you like?
Absolutely, and again, in Indian philosophies, we have Ayurvedic readers who will tell you which stones suit you and also where you should wear those stones. So typically, a yellow sapphire is often worn on your right hand index finger, and it must be touching your skin. We've even had sessions at the boutique, and we're trying to find the right priest or Ayurvedic reader to come into Harrods so we can offer this to clients where you can, they'll sit and look at where you were born on the exact time and the exact date, and accordingly they'll look at your charts and the alignment of the planets.
Oh,
very romantic.
Yeah, it's exactly what jewelry is, right? It's about connecting with your emotions. And I used to be quite skeptical about these things, but I really do believe in the power and the energy of stones and natural stones.
So you have two emeralds around your neck.
Yeah.
And what does that symbolize?
That's because I believe in alchemy. So right. An alchemist should always have, I'm not saying that I'm an alchemist, but I believe in it, an emerald tablet, which is your truth of the world. So emeralds are my truth of the world, and emeralds by far from all gemstones are usually very included. So they're really interesting to look at or look inside when you look with a loop. So I always wear an emerald, at least one, but actually I never take these two off. The other thing which I do is I don't do it every month, but every few months, every 3-4 months, I cleanse them in the full moonlight. They must be in the moonlight and they need to be cleaned to take the energies out.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
What happens if it's cloudy?
It needs to be in direct moonlight. So I do look out for it, and I do put it near my skylight on the top floor so I can really get the moonlight in on them.
That's amazing. Now, you trained as a gemologist, didn't you?
I did, yes. I went to GIA many years ago, 2001 and 2002.
How long is that training?
It's 10 months full-time. They have a school in London as well. So I went to the one here, which is in just near Tottenham Court Road.
And so that was the gemology, which was the stones themselves. And can we talk a little bit about the design now? Because Amrapali is a very specific sort of type of design.
Yep.
It's very Indian. And there's a lot of sort of, Indian culture is so rich in sort of mythology and legend and religion. And it feels like it's got a lot of that in it.
We're very proud of that. And that's exactly what we're trying to transmit, is transmit that Indian heritage without being an overly Indian jeweler making big wedding pieces. Because in the day and the times that we live, everyone dresses a lot more casual. So having a nice statement earrings with colour and some Indian techniques and showing that Indian-ness without being so Indian that you look like you're going to an Indian wedding.
Without being clichéd.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Now, Samir, you've got a very intriguing-looking pouch in front of you.
Yes.
I ask if you could bring something along to show us.
I brought a few pieces in to play with.
Lovely. What have you got?
I'm going to start with, I'll start with the traditional piece, as we're talking about tradition.
Mm.
So this is Zambian
goodness.
Emerald.
It's a huge...
I'm going to give you the exact carat weight.
It's probably about 1.5 centimetres by 1.5 centimetres.
Yes, 24 carats.
24 carats,
yeah.
Oh my goodness.
And...
By the way, Stacey's jaw's on the floor.
My eyes are so wide.
6.5 carats of diamonds. I chose this actually because I was looking for a big emerald ring, and on the Harrods Instagram, this was featured back in February, so people could see it. It's on the styling.
I know, yeah.
And it's a very traditional filigree setting.
Well, you say it's traditional, but actually it is that thing that I love about Amrapali, which is that it is extraordinarily flamboyant because it is so big, it's surrounded by diamonds, it's got the gold filigree.
And we like to think not being overly flashy. It's substantial without being...
It's not bling.
No.
It's, yeah. Oh, it looks perfect, Stacey. She's got it on her finger and...
And it fits well as well.
The green and the red hair. It's beautiful.
And if you look on the underside, we have a nice detail of a bird.
Oh,
in
that's
diamonds.
Exquisite. Look at that. How many diamonds are on there?
If you look on the ticket, it should say, but I think there must be about 200-ish, mm-hmm. give or take. And it's around 6 carats of diamonds.
Wow. It is beautiful.
And who would buy that sort of ring? Where would they be from? How old would they be?
So this is something we think about very, very carefully. Typically, we do very well with Middle Easterns. Doha and Qatar being a very strong market for us. We have a boutique there.
Because they're so brave with their jewellery choices.
They are.
I love these women. They really go for it with their jewellery.
Yeah. Or we have a lot of Europeans who kind of graduate up. So they may start with, actually, that's a bit too big for me. And I'll start with a 2 or 3 carat. And over time...
It's a perfect size for you, Stacey.
Yeah. I think
it looks rather good on me as well.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Smith. So kind.
Anytime. So it's really... the idea with our jewellery is that it's not for a specific person or a specific target market, but that it can transcend that. And it's really about the stones.
Mm. And where's this emerald from?
This is Zambian emerald with a minor oil.
Stunning. Show me what else you've got.
Then the second piece which I bought was an antique spinel, which came from a royal collection in India.
Sorry, what's a spinel?
A spinel is another kind of coloured stone, which comes in a variety of hues, generally speaking in purples and
they're very fashionable
British.
Now.
Yeah, they are. And actually in the crown jewels, in the English crown jewels, what they thought were rubies and were described as rubies are actually spinels.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In the Queen's collection?
Yeah, with the red stones, they're spinels.
Ah, and where are they from, spinels?
Spinels come from typically originally India, but now you find them in Africa and you also find them in parts of Asia, Thailand.
It's more of a browny red, isn't it?
This one's going to, they have great transparency. This one's a slightly purplish red.
Hmm.
And the way we've set this is it was, to give a contrast, this is a much more traditional setting. This is in a very contemporary white gold pave setting.
And you can see all the way through the stone as well. It's almost like it hangs like a pendant.
Yeah, exactly. And then when you look on the backside, you can actually see the detail. So it's a very botanical motif with a lotus flower, rose-cut diamond.
Oh, I love it.
It's exquisite.
It's inspiring. So you don't see that in anything else, do you? It's completely original.
It's very important for us as a brand. We're not like anyone else, and we don't want to be like anyone else. We want to be us. We want to be bold. We want to be different. And we're very proud of our heritage, but we want to make it accessible to a much wider audience.
Well, yes,
God, it fits my engagement finger.
But I think if you're going to make that kind of investment in a piece of jewellery, you don't want it to just be a discreet thing, do you? Sometimes you want it to make a statement, right?
I hope so, yes. Yes.
Yeah. It's something you're going to wear forever and something that you're going to pass down to your children. I think people are being more experimental.
I think so. And I think that more and more, particularly in the UK, we've become more, we want to have fun and we're happy to wear things for fun. It's not just about having a white gold diamond line necklace, which is great, but it's kind of a staple.
But I do wonder if that, to your point earlier, whether because we're dressing down and we're in sweatshirts or simple, you know, grey cashmere jumpers and that sets off the earrings, it feels less blingy. There's a balance of high-low.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And also layering. People are a lot more accustomed. I mean, you look at the brands here in Harrods, and a lot of them, it's all about layering and collections and each piece telling a story. And this was given to me for my graduation. This is from my wedding, from my husband. This was from my parents.
Stories.
The rules of you must have a yellow gold watch if you're wearing yellow gold jewelry. No longer. You can mix and match, and it's quite acceptable. And everyone's doing it,
and not saving it for best. So like not having it locked up in the safe at home, only to get it out once every 4 years.
Exactly. Which is again, it's pieces which are wearable rather than having these huge big ornate necklaces which you can only wear with a dress on a special occasion.
It's depressing, the thought of things just sitting in a safe, isn't it?
For me, that's my worst. My worst thing is when people commission things or buy things. Please wear it. Please enjoy it.
Well, actually, that was one of the things I was going to ask you. Is Amrapali, obviously, you say is headquartered in Jaipur and it's an Indian brand, and you were the one that kind of brought it over and opened it and brought it to this market, to Britain, to London. Did you have to change any of the designs to suit us Londoners?
Yes, we do have specific. I mean, we have specific collections for us, and we also have specific things because of our laws in this country. So to go on to the more technical side, for example, hallmarking, everything which is jewellery here, which is hallmarked, has to be hallmarked, and it's the lowest purity of gold in the piece. So we may have a 22-carat gold earring, which is very soft gold. So on the post, they'd use 14-carat gold so that it's more practical when you're using it. However, over here in the UK, that will then become hallmarked as a 14-carat gold piece of jewellery. So it's very important for the collections that I bring over here that those posts are then 18-carat. So that at least I get an 18-carat gold hallmarking, and it doesn't devalue the perception of what the whole piece is. So that was the technical aspect. In terms of design, yes, actually a lot of what I do is kind of dilute slightly. So there's this, with the Indian design, as you said, it's very rich, there's so much culture, but sometimes they can overdo it. And as somebody of Indian origin, but born and brought up here, I can kind of sympathize between the two, and I dilute and I'll take one or two elements from a collection and make that into our simplified, diluted version of the Indian version.
So are you kind of a creative director too?
I like to think of myself, but I don't think I quite have enough talent to sit there and design myself.
So is it designed back in the workshop in Jaipur? How does it work?
So I actually have a designer who works for me here in the UK. And in Jaipur, I have designers who are allocated to me. And I kind of, we go on that process together. Before I was with Amrapali, I spent 10 years with Cartier, and I was actually a creative manager for a year or so in Milan. So I understand this process.
As a woman, to be gifted a piece of jewelry is one of the most moving and profound and romantic
things.
It's
so incredible. I got a coffee making machine from my push present.
I hope it was a DeLonghi one, though.
No, John Lewis.
I think you need to send your husband to me. We'll talk.
That can be arranged.
So we started something here in Harrods, which we did a world launch of, which is called the Gem Bar. And the idea of that was to actually show people and get people involved, and particularly men, because they're interested a lot more. Men are great watch buyers, but jewelry they buy for wives. So it was.
And they're quite paralyzed sometimes with what to get them. It's quite a scary thing, right?
Exactly that. So it was actually take people along this journey, and actually men can sometimes have the tendency to make very bad choices in jewelry as well. So it's like, you know what? Yes. Let's start with a stone. And then we can build the piece, and then you can even gift the stone, and we can give it in what we'd call in the trade a dealer setting, so a very basic setting. So you can gift it like that and then come back with your wife, and we can have afternoon tea in the Georgian when it's open. And you can sit with the designers, and we can actually design that piece of jewelry. So from the gemstone, the jewelry becomes your personal piece of jewelry.
So completely collaborative.
Yeah.
I love that.
Exactly. Did you see the gem bar? The little moving...
It's great fun, and it's doing really, really well for us. Initially, I thought it was great marketing, but I think more and more people are coming just to see the Gem Bar and to understand it, and understanding that actually you can be involved in that process of making your piece of jewelry and what you like from there, as opposed to just going in and buying something for tens or hundreds or millions of pounds.
I don't know how many stones are in that moving kind of, I call it a sushi. It's like a little sushi, you know,
conveyor belt.
Thank you. But one of the most fun I've ever had in the store is try to guess the most expensive stone in the in the gem bar with a member of your team.
And that's something which I'm very interested in is the juxtaposition of having an amethyst, which maybe is at £1,500, and next to it you have a purple or a pink diamond of Vivid, which is almost £1 million. And we very specifically have those pieces next to each other to show that it and is meant to be accessible. So it's not that you have to come in and it's going to be millions of pounds. But actually something which is £1,000.
You can pick up a really beautiful stone for about £1,500.
Starting from. I think that. I actually wanted to have this price point starting at £1,000 for a loose gemstone, so that it's still a substantial amount of money, but it's not crazy, and it means that anybody can, in theory, go in there and buy a gemstone.
Samir, thank you so much for coming in and showing us your absolutely beautiful jewelry and inspiring us as well with all the sort of the stories behind it. It's been lovely having you, and come back again soon.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, both of you.
That brings us to the end of this episode of the True Tales of Luxury podcast. A huge thank you to Samir Lilani for swinging by to enlighten us about all things Amrapali. Such exquisite jewellery, and what a fascinating story. If you haven't already, then go back and discover the previous three episodes in this series. Please do subscribe if you'd like to receive more episodes as soon as they become available. The final two episodes of this series will be appearing in your podcast app in the very near future. As always, thank you so much for listening, and bye-bye for now.